Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 8, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. All eyes on Kennedy and gay marriage case. What happened? Oral arguments took place this week in the landmark Supreme Court case on whether same-sex couples have a constitutional right to marry, leaving both sides anxiously scrutinizing the ambivalent comments of Justice Anthony Kennedy, the likely swing voter. During 2.5 hours of tense debate over the legality of the gay marriage bans in Michigan, Kentucky, Ohio, and Tennessee, Kennedy began by asking why 9 unelected justices should redefine a concept that has existed for millennia. Later, however, he made an explicit comparison between laws banning gay marriage and laws banning interracial marriage, and expressed doubts about denying homosexual couples the dignity of marriage, a central theme in his previous opinions in favor of gay rights. Why, he asked, don't same-sex couples deserve the same ennoblement as their heterosexual counterparts? The rest of the court was divided along clearer ideological lines. Conservative justices Antonin Scalia and Samuel Alito Jr. pointedly noted that prior to 2000, no society in history had allowed same-sex couples to marry, while liberal justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor all questioned the idea that same-sex marriages would harm heterosexual unions. Chief Justice John Roberts gave some mixed signals. He noted that public opinion was rapidly changing in favor of gay marriage and warned that a Supreme Court ruling forcing it on unwilling states will have a consequence on how this new institution is accepted. But Roberts also suggested that gay marriage bans could be struck down on simple grounds of gender discrimination. If Sue loves Joe and Tom loves Joe, he said, Sue can marry him and Tom can't. The court's decision is expected in June. What the editorial said. The shift in consensus in favor of gay marriage is perhaps the fastest political transformation in U.S. history, said the Wall Street Journal. Many Republican politicians are probably praying the justices take this controversial issue off the table once and for all. But the Constitution never mentions marriage, and the Supreme Court should think twice about short-circuiting public debate. When in doubt, better to let judicial modesty and the wisdom of the people prevail. Opponents of gay marriage have no valid legal argument, said the Washington Post. Their principal objection, voiced in court, that same-sex couples can't procreate, is immaterial, now that gay couples have proven quite capable of producing and raising well-adjusted children. As for the theory that this decision should be left to the individual states, so as to avoid another polarizing Roe v. Wade ruling, that would place thousands of existing same-sex unions into limbo. Besides, fundamental rights are not subject to the vagaries of majoritarian politics. What the columnist said. Kennedy's chin-stroking aside, a ruling that redefines marriage looks like a foregone conclusion, said Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com. But we religious conservatives have valid reasons to worry what that will mean. What society teaches about the link between sex, marriage, and procreation has major implications for how, when, and whether people couple, marry, and raise children. There's nothing more important to a society's health And we were right when we warned that no-fault divorce, sexual permissiveness, and Roe v. Wade would lead to a serious erosion of the family, an explosion of single-parent families, and social decay. Ultimately, this train cannot be stopped, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. By a 58-34 margin, American voters now support same-sex marriage, while a similar proportion reject the notion that businesses should be allowed to refuse services to gays and lesbians on religious grounds. Today, gay marriage opponents resemble the Japanese soldiers in 1946 who fought on from bunkers on a remote island because they had not found out the war was over. Predicting Supreme Court rulings is tricky business, said Noah Feldman in BloombergView.com. But in three major cases over the past two decades, Kennedy has written opinions that have carefully built the scaffolding to expand full equality to gay citizens. He may agonize a bit over completing that momentous project, but in the end, Kennedy is going to do the right thing. And a second main story, Baltimore on edge after riots. What happened? A force of 3,000 National Guard troops and state and local police imposed a tense peace on Baltimore this week after riots erupted over the death of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old black man who suffered a severe severed spine while in police custody. Just hours after Gray's funeral, rioters in West Baltimore set ablaze a CVS store, looted businesses, and hurled bricks at police, prompting Maryland Governor Larry Hogan to declare a state of emergency. At least 235 people were arrested, including dozens of high school students. The violence waned as gang members joined hands with community leaders to form a barrier between protesters and police. But fear of renewed violence led the Baltimore Orioles to take the unprecedented step of closing a Major League Baseball game to the public. President Obama condemned the rioters as criminals and thugs, but in some of his most candid remarks on police brutality, he also said Gray's death was part of a slow-rolling crisis that has been going on for a long time. Baltimore's police department suspended six officers pending an investigation into Gray's death, and the Justice Department opened its own civil rights inquiry. The original police report claimed Gray was arrested without force or incident on April 12th after running away from police in an area known for drug activity. He was put into a police van, unbelted, and fell into a coma an hour later. This has prompted speculation that Gray was injured during a rough ride in which officers throw handcuffed suspects into a police wagons and subject them to high-speed stops and starts. What the editorial said. At this stage, it's impossible to know how or why Gray died, said the New York Times. The same can't be said of Baltimore's eruption, the roots of which were laid out in a damning 2014 Baltimore Sun investigation that found the city had paid out $5.7 million to settle police abuse claims since 2011. Victims included a 15-year-old boy riding a dirt bike and an 87-year-old grandmother. That culture of police brutality set a stage for just this kind of unrest. None of that excuses the knuckleheaded rioters who laid waste to the neighborhoods where they live, said the Washington Post. Perhaps real progress would be made if more residents were like the angry mother who was caught on camera giving her son a beating for joining the mayhem. Instead, teens were allowed to run wild, said the Baltimore Sun. The community may have real grievances against the police, but all these rioters did is confirm the ugly stereotypes that underlie the very injustices the demonstrators are trying to protest. What the columnist said. Baltimore is very different from Ferguson, the last scene of anti-police riots, said Matthew Loftus in the AmericanConservative.com. Its mayor is black, its city council has a black majority, and many of its police officers are black. Yet just as in the Missouri suburb, stories abound of residents being pulled over, roughed up, and arrested for no reason. When one Baltimore officer tried to report the abuse, he found a dead rat on his car. It's far too late for politicians and officials to call for calm, said Ta-Nehisi Coates in TheAtlantic.com. There was no official appeal for calm when Gray was arrested and had his spine severed, or when scores of other black victims of Baltimore's police had their bodies beaten and bones broken. Why should Baltimore residents agree to be nonviolent halfway through the war, when the state has spent years doling out heaps of violence to its citizens? But this rioting will do nothing but harm the very people rioting, said Jack Millman in TheFederalist.com. It's not just city officials who have condemned the violence, but community leaders who have spent years trying to revive Baltimore, a city where a quarter of the residents live below the poverty line. Wealthy owners of burned businesses will be fine. They have insurance, and those who live in the city can leave. The people who will suffer the most from the riots will be Baltimore's poor and minority citizens who will remain trapped in ravaged, jobless neighborhoods. Our controversy of the week, drone warfare. Does the U.S. really know who it's killing? You would think it would rank among the most serious and legitimate scandals of his presidency, said Jim Newell in Salon.com. President Obama admitted last week that a CIA drone strike in Pakistan accidentally killed two kidnapped aid workers, proving the supposed safeguards against killing civilians are a sham. But the reaction to the two men's deaths in Washington, even from Obama's Republican foes, was a collective, oh well. Warren Weinstein, an American, and Giovanni Loporto, an Italian, died when a missile fired from a U.S. drone struck the Al-Qaeda compound where they were being held hostage. Under CIA rules, drone operators supposedly fire only when there is clear certainty of the identities of the targets and near certainty that non-combatants will not be injured or killed. In reality, U.S. officials simply fired a missile at a compound in Pakistan's tribal regions that they believed terrorists were using, discovering only later that they'd killed two Al-Qaeda militants as well as Weinstein and Loporto. The president offered his deepest apologies to the families of Weinstein and Loporto, said Trevor Tim in TheGuardian.com. But what about the hundreds of Pakistani, Afghan, and Yemeni civilians killed by U.S. drones? We need a full-scale, independent investigation of the human rights catastrophe caused by this secretive, lawless program. Sorry, folks, said Ralph Peters in the New York Post, but that's war. The deaths of Weinstein and Loporto are obviously regrettable, but we cannot halt all counterterrorism efforts because Al-Qaeda takes hostages. U.S. intelligence officials report that drone strikes have taken out 40 Al-Qaeda leaders in Pakistan in just the past 6 months and have left the decimated core of that group incapable of meeting to plot terrorist attacks. Let's not forget that these jihadists would gladly nuke our cities if they had the chance. Drones are not a perfect tool, said Tom Rogan in NationalReview.com, but without them we would have no adequate means of defense against terrorists using remote areas of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen to plot murder against the world. But for every terrorist we eliminate, how many do we create? Asked Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. Yes, drone strikes have devastated Al-Qaeda Central, but since those attacks began in 2008, Al-Qaeda's Yemeni branch has grown to some 1,000 members, and Yemen's government was toppled by Houthi tribesmen angry that the U.S. had been given free rein to attack their country. The perception that the U.S. callously kills Muslim civilians has also helped the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria recruit thousands of young men. In the big picture, the evidence that drone strikes diminish terrorism is less than clear. It is clear, however, that for civilians, drone attacks are the safest form of war in modern history, said William Salatin in Slate.com. In World War II, up to 67% of the dead were noncombatants. In Vietnam, the figure was around 50%. And in Iraq, 80% of those killed since 2003 have been civilians. By contrast, the civilian casualty rate from U.S. drones in Pakistan has been only 24% by the harshest estimate, and possibly as low as 5%. And in Yemen, civilian drone deaths have numbered between 8% and 15%. If the goal is to avoid killing civilians, replacing drones with conventional warfare would be the worst thing you could do. Well, it was a good week for Catholic retention after Pope Francis urged a group of newly ordained priests to make sure that your sermons are not boring. It was a good week for going down market after the divorcing actress Hilary Duff said she was now using the dating app Tinder in an effort to meet a non-celebrity. "I've never dated a total normie," Duff said, using the Hollywood term for a, quote, normal person. It was a good week for friend of the court briefs after a spectator interrupted Supreme Court oral arguments on gay marriage by shouting, "If you support gay marriage, you will burn in hell. It's an abomination." After the man was removed, conservative Justice Antonin Scalia called the outburst rather refreshing, actually. It was a bad week for sharing after a 27-year-old Texas woman posted on Facebook, "I start my new job today, but I absolutely hate working at daycare." Her new employer heard about her comments and advised her she no longer had a job she hated. It was a bad week for rebranding after officials in Tisdale, Saskatchewan, famous for its rapeseed, a crop used to make animal feed and biofuels, told residents it was time to change their "Land of Rape and Honey" slogan. The often mocked slogan, officials said, was shining an unwanted spotlight on the town. And it was a bad week for government shutdowns after hundreds of legislators and workers at the Iowa Capitol had to be evacuated when someone's lunch overcooked in a microwave, setting off fire alarms. No one came forward to claim the charred mac and cheese. Turn now to the briefing page. Europe's migrant crisis. Record numbers of migrants are drowning while trying to flee the Mideast and Africa for Europe. Why do they keep coming? How many people are dying? Since January, an estimated 1,750 migrants have drowned trying to reach Europe via boat, a greater death toll than the Titanic's. Hoping to escape the war, poverty, and violence of their own countries in Africa and the Middle East, these desperate refugees pay up to $2,000 each for a spot on one of the overloaded rickety fishing vessels or rubber dinghies crossing the Mediterranean every day. Last year, a staggering 215,000 migrants successfully reached Europe, most landing in Italy. Italy sent only 5,000 home. The rest disappeared into the continent, with many headed to Northern Europe in search of work and better lives. But often these voyages end in tragedy, such as the April 19th disaster, in which about 900 refugees drowned en route from Libya, with another million migrants reportedly waiting in Libya to cross the dangerous seas. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights has warned that European leaders must do something to stem the crisis, or they risk turning the Mediterranean into a vast cemetery. Where are the boats coming from? About 80% of migrants set sail from the failed state of Libya, where a multi-million dollar smuggling business has sprung up in the chaotic aftermath of the 2011 revolution. Last year, a vast network of Libyan militias collaborated with Italian crime syndicates to make an estimated $170 million in people smuggling. The traffickers exploit migrants who have traveled more than 1,000 miles from the countries as diverse as Niger, Iraq, Somalia, and Eritrea to start a new life. An estimated 31% are from Syria, driven away by the horrific civil war. These are the most desperate people, says Flavio Di Giacomo from the International Organization of Migration. They know the voyages are perilous, but they are stuck between hell and the deep blue sea. Why do so many boats sink? To maximize their profits, smugglers pack masses of migrants into cheap, barely seaworthy boats. In last week's tragedy, the 900 migrants were crammed into a 66-foot wooden fishing boat. When too many passengers lean on one side of those ramshackle vessels, they capsize. Even worse, hundreds of poor African migrants are often locked into the boat's teeming hold for crowd control. So if the ship goes down, they have no choice but to go down with it. Sometimes smugglers put migrants on a boat with no captain, hand them a compass, and tell them to find their own way to Europe. Rescue boats save some of these lost vessels, but many wind up sinking or capsizing. The death toll has grown astronomically since the demise of Operation Mare Nostrum last November. What's that? Mare Nostrum, or Our Sea, was an Italian naval rescue operation launched after 300 people drowned off the Italian island of Lampedusa in October 2013. At a monthly cost of $9.7 million, Italian rescue boats trawled the Mediterranean looking for migrants in distress, ultimately saving and bringing back to Italy more than 140,000 refugees in a single year. But the operation fell victim to political opposition. Italian lawmakers claimed migrants were using the rescue boats as a taxi service and called on the EU to help fund the costly program. Instead, European leaders axed the operation altogether. Why did Europe back out? Britain was one of many countries that claimed Mare Nostrum was creating an unintended pull factor for migrants. If they knew there was a good chance they'd be rescued, they were more likely to risk the journey. The EU instead embraced a new Fortress Europe approach, tightening the borders and launching the limited Triton program, which only searches the waters within 30 miles of Italy's coastline. But Triton has done nothing to drive down migrant numbers, which remain as high as in 2014, when about 26,000 refugees crossed over in the first 4 months of the year. The only thing that's changed is the number of deaths, which has multiplied 30 times. By April 21st in 2014, 56 people had died. This year, by that date, 1,727 had. When Operation Mare Nostrum was cut, we said it would be a death sentence, said Save the Children's Gimma Parkin, and it has been just that. What's the solution? Facing an international outcry after last week's disaster, EU leaders cobbled together a 10-point plan that triples Triton funding and pledges to destroy smugglers' boats in Libya. But many migrant advocates argue that that plan doesn't go far enough. Some European lawmakers are for adopting Australia's controversial approach. Human rights experts argue that the crisis will exist as long as Middle Eastern and African countries remain in chaos. Instead of treating these migrants like criminals, they say, Europe should provide safe migration routes. But European nations say they are already struggling to absorb the hundreds of thousands of migrants who have already landed on the continent's shores. We're swamped, said Italy's Minister for European Affairs. There's not even enough space in Sicily's cemeteries to bury the dead. Australia's closed-door policy. When a wave of Iraqi and Afghan migrants set sail for Australia 5 years ago, lawmakers down under responded by adopting one of the world's harshest border policies. There would be absolutely no resettlement of migrants, the Australian government announced. Instead, the migrants would be towed back to the Indonesian ports they'd set off from, or imprisoned in detention centers in remote Papua New Guinea before being shipped to destinations such as Cambodia. On the surface, the policy has worked. Since 2013, only 16 migrant boats have attempted the journey to Australia. But migrant advocates argue Australia hasn't stopped the boats at all. What Australia has done is just displace the issue away from the shores of Australia and toward the Mediterranean, says Paul Power of the Refugee Council of Australia. They have almost without doubt made the situation worse for people who have tried to find safety in Europe. Moving on to the columns, this from Dana Milbank at the Washington Post. Citizens United is hurting the GOP. When the Supreme Court invited the rich to pour unlimited sums into political campaigns with its Citizens United ruling, said Dana Milbank, Republican leaders were ecstatic. But that ruling is now backfiring on the GOP. Billionaire donors who adopt candidates the way Medici's adopted artists are now pouring so much money into primary campaigns that it's washing away the Darwinian system of natural selection. In the past, if candidates polled poorly or got badly beaten in early primaries, their money would dry up and they'd have to drop out. But now, unelectable candidates can be sustained by massive influx of their patrons' cash. Prolonging the preliminary process and watering down the collective wisdom of voters. In 2012, billionaire Sheldon Adelson's money kept the unelectable Newt Gingrich in the race far too long, forcing Mitt Romney to the right and perhaps costing him the general election. Something similar could easily happen this time around, with Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, and Ted Cruz all amassing huge war chests. In a world of unlimited contributions, the sacred concept of one man, one vote no longer has much meaning. Jonathan Sherman at the New York Times writes, "Let cameras into the Supreme Court." Something was missing from this week's oral arguments about same-sex marriage before the U.S. Supreme Court, said Jonathan Sherman. TV cameras that would have let the entire nation see the historic proceedings. Despite countless entreaties from transparency groups, the nation's highest court still bans photos, video footage, and even live audio of proceedings, meaning that only the tiny number of Americans who stand in line for a public gallery seat actually witness the lawyers' presentations and the justices' questions. Why? Justice Anthony Kennedy has stated that televising arguments might introduce an insidious dynamic in which justices play to the cameras. In other words, the justices simply don't like the idea of being seen as they exercise enormous power. But in 1980, the court recognized that the public had a First Amendment right to attend court proceedings. And in the modern era, technology has amplified our ability to see events that we cannot attend. Supreme Court justices have a major impact on every aspect of American life, including marriage, health care, and elections. Why are we forbidden to see that process in action? And this from India. Farmer suicides as political spectacle. A despairing farmer killed himself in public, and India's politicians can only point fingers, said Rana Ayub in NDTV.com. Gahendra Singh, 43, climbed a tree and hanged himself during a rally against the government's new land acquisition bill last week. A suicide note said his crop had failed and he could not support his three children. Singh joins a long list of farmers who have committed suicide, about 200,000 over the past 18 years. By taking his life in front of the cameras, this farmer wanted to send out a message to our political outfits to stop playing their political games at the expense of his ilk. Alas, even before Singh's body was cremated, the shameful political blame game had begun. The opposition Aam Aadmi Party, organizers of the rally, claimed the suicide was a stunt to make them look bad. The ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, in turn, asserted that Aam Aadmi had staged the incident to try to scupper the land bill. Lost in the spectacle was any real concern for the starving children. Our farmers are in desperate straits, said Chaitanya Kalbag in the Economic Times. The banks won't lend to them, so they borrow from blood-sucking moneylenders at outrageous rates or become sharecroppers, handing over part of their profits to a landlord. Crops fail for many reasons: drought, hailstorms, unseasonable rain, flooding, and the farmers, most of whom work unsustainably small plots, have no savings at all. One bad season can ruin them. Indian farmers seem to have their backs to the wall. It's no wonder so many just give up hope. Actually, farmers are no more likely to commit suicide than other Indians, said Sumit Mitra in firstpost.com. Farmers' deaths just get a lot of press because agricultural reform is such a hot issue. But statistics show that the suicidal rate among farmers and agricultural workers is nearly four times lower than for the general population. The shrill campaigning about farmer suicide is nothing more than a clever ploy to divert attention and funds. Every time a suicide is hyped, a state government comes up with a popular relief package that will surely win voters at the next election. You have to be blind not to see this crisis is real, said Namita Badare in Hindustan Times. At least 30% of rural Indians live in desperate poverty. That's some 300 million people. The problem is that few people in India's fast-growing cities care about their country cousins anymore. We normally only talk about farmers when we want to acquire their land for our highways and industries. There are signs that large parts of India will again be hit by drought this year, adding to the rural distress. Will we listen? Will we care? Turn now to the last word, our in-depth article. The title this week, Tech's Quest for Immortality. Silicon Valley's billionaires have a new project, said Ariana Onjung Cha. They want to defy death. Seated at the head of a table for 12 with a view of San Francisco's soaring skyline, Peter Thiel was in deep conversation with his guest, eclectic scientist whose research was considered radical, even heretical. It was 2004, and Thiel had recently made a tidy fortune selling PayPal, which he had co-founded, to eBay. He had spent what he wanted on himself, a posh penthouse suite at the Four Seasons Hotel and a silver Ferrari, and was now soliciting ideas to do good with his money. Among the guests was Cynthia Kenyon, a molecular biologist and biogerontologist who had garnered attention for doubling the lifespan of a roundworm by disabling a single gene. Aubrey de Grey, a British computer scientist turned theoretician who prophesied that medical advances would stop aging. And Larry Page, co-founder of an internet search darling called Google that had big ideas to improve health through the terabytes of data it was collecting. The chatter at the dinner party meandered from the value of chocolate in one's diet to the merits of uploading people's memories to a computer versus cryo-freezing their bodies. Yet the focus kept returning to one subject. Was death an inevitability or a solvable problem? A number of guests were skeptical about achieving immortality. But could science and technology help us live longer, to say 150 years? Now that, they agreed, was a worthy goal. Within a few months, Theo had written checks to Kenyon and de Grey to accelerate their work. Since then, he has doled out millions to other researchers with what he calls breakout ideas that defy conventional wisdom. If you think you can only do very little and be very incremental, then you'll work only on very incremental things. It's self-fulfilling, said Theo, who is 47 and estimated to be worth $2.2 billion. It's those who have an optimism about what can be done who will shape the future. He and the tech titans who founded Google, Facebook, eBay, Napster, and Netscape are using their billions to rewrite the nation's science agenda and transform biomedical research. Their objective is to use the tools of technology, the software programs, algorithms, and big data they used in creating an information revolution, to understand and upgrade what they consider to be the most complicated piece of machinery in existence, the human body. The entrepreneurs are driven by a certitude that rebuilding, regenerating, and reprogramming patients' organs, limbs, cells, and DNA will enable people to live longer and better. The work they are funding includes hunting for the secrets of living organisms with insanely long lives, engineering microscopic nanobots that can fix your body from the inside out, figuring out how to reprogram the DNA you were born with, and exploring ways to digitize your brain based on the theory that your mind could live long after your body expires. Their confidence in technological wizardry and their own ideas may lead them to underestimate the downsides and even the dangers of the work they are funding, say some science philosophers, historians, and economists. Their research in stem cells, neuroscience, genetically modified organisms, and viruses, for example, tinkers with nature in big ways that could easily go awry, and operates in a largely unregulated space. Laurie Zoloth, a bioethicist at Northwestern University, worries that some of the billionaires' obsession with longevity may be driven as much by hubris as by a desire to do public good. It's incredibly exciting and wonderful to be part of a species that dreams in a big way, she said. But I also want to be part of a species that takes care of the poor and the dying. And I'm worried that our attention is being drawn away to a glittery future world that is fantasy and not the world we live in. For many of the tech entrepreneurs and philanthropists, interest in medical science is personal. Sean Parker, 34, the Napster co-founder, suffers from life-threatening food allergies and has family members with autoimmune disorders. He has donated millions to finding a cure for allergies and to new cancer therapies. Google's Sergey Brin, 41, has proposed a new kind of science that starts with masses of DNA and a community of people with certain genes. Brin has a mutation of the LRRK2 gene that is associated with a higher risk of Parkinson's disease, and has said he thinks the new approach could be transformational. He has donated $150 million to the effort. Several of the Silicon Valley billionaires married women with backgrounds in science or medicine, and those wives direct the philanthropy. And Ann Wojcicki, Brin's estranged wife, who studied biology and previously worked as a healthcare consultant, founded her own personalized genetic startups, 23andMe, and is co-head of the couple's foundation. Priscilla Chan, a pediatric resident at the University of California at San Francisco, with her husband, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, age 30, donated $75 million to San Francisco General Hospital, where 70% of the patients are underinsured or uninsured. The two couples also teamed up with others to create the Breakthrough Prize for scientists who make discoveries that extend human life. Its $3 million payouts, given to six scientists each year, dwarf similar awards, including the Nobel Prizes, currently about $925,000. Pam Omidyar, a biologist and former research assistant in an immunology lab, co-founded the Omidyar Network with her husband, eBay's Pierre Omidyar, who became a billionaire at 31. They have donated millions to research about resiliency, the traits that help people bounce back from illness or other adversity. And Paige, who is now 42 and chief executive of Google, has made the biggest bet on longevity yet, founding Calico, short for California Life Company, a secretive anti-aging research center with an investment of up to $750 million from Google. Lara Arriaga Andreessen, who is the wife of internet pioneer Mark Andreessen and a well-known philanthropist, said that when many tech entrepreneurs look at the healthcare system, they see the data of billions of people collected through blood tests, online profiles, and fitness trackers. When that data can be accessed and mined and utilized for good in an instantaneous manner, she said, that would be shattering in a positive way for the system as we know it. Such moonshot ideas are tantalizing, but some prominent ethicists and scientists have been troubled by the tech titan's unwavering conviction that conquering nature is desirable in the first place. And there are few checks and balances on such initiatives. Once, two-thirds of scientific and medical research was funded by the federal government, beholden to the public good. Now, two-thirds is funded by private industry, a growing share by billionaires accountable to no one and impatient with the pace of innovation. Zoloth, the Northwestern University bioethicist, said there is a reason why science moves slowly. Making scientific progress faster doesn't necessarily mean better, unless if you're an aging philanthropist and want an answer in your lifetime, she said. Science is about an arc of knowledge, and it can take a long time to play out. Sometimes we won't know answers for generations. Americans remain deeply ambivalent about using new medical treatments to live radically longer lives. In a 2013 survey conducted by the Pew Research Center, 51% said they believed treatments to slow, stop, or reverse aging would have a negative impact on society. 58% said treatments that would allow people to live decades longer would be fundamentally unnatural. Political theorist Francis Fukuyama, a senior fellow at Stanford and former member of the President's Council on Bioethics, argues that a large increase in human life spans would take away people's motivation for the adaptation necessary for survival. In that kind of world, social change comes to a standstill, he said. Aging dictators could stay in power for centuries. I think that research into life extension is going to end up being a big social disaster, Fukuyama said in an interview. Extending the average human lifespan is a great example of something that is individually desirable by almost everyone, but collectively not a good thing. For evolutionary reasons, there is a good reason why we die when we do. Although many scientists say they are grateful for the entrepreneurs' money and attention, some have been dismayed by what they see as Silicon Valley's superiority complex and insistence that the current methods used to fight disease are outdated and ineffective. At a medical conference in August 2012, for instance, Vinod Khosla, one of Silicon Valley's most revered venture capitalists, likened the practice of medicine to witchcraft. He argued that machines are better than the average doctor, and that disruption in healthcare was more likely to be driven by those outside the industry than those in the profession. The reaction from the medical community was swift. Columbia University educated physician B. John Salehizadeh tweeted that he was nauseated by the anti-doctor rantings of the Silicon Valley tech crowd. Some scientists also say they are concerned that private money, which can include seven-figure research grants and salaries that are two or three times what is offered in academia, distorts research priorities. Preston Estep, director of gerontology for Harvard Medical School's Personal Genome Project, says that some of the philanthropists are doing more harm than good by funding what he calls pseudoscience, approaches based more on emotional appeal than on solid research. Of some of the work that is being funded by the tech crowd, he said, nobody takes it seriously. Peter Thiel is the embodiment of Silicon Valley culture at its individualistic, impatient extreme. He believes death is the great enemy of humankind. He said that in the past 25 years, the pace of innovation in biomedical realm has been demoralizing. Nixon declared war on cancer in 1971, and there has been frustratingly slow progress, he said. One-third of people ages 85 and older have Alzheimer's or dementia, and we're not even motivated to start a war on Alzheimer's. Thiel's philanthropic investments in aging grew out of a series of late-night conversations with a friend, author Sonia Arison. Her best-selling book, 100 Plus, lays out a future where living longer is the new norm. For them, the possibility of a long life, perhaps to 150, nearly doubling the current average U.S. life expectancy, was exciting. Staying up late at night, the two would muse about ideas such as whether it was possible to bioengineer immune cells to recognize and kill cancer, or whether we could one day 3D print human skin for burn victims. All sorts of different strategies to repair people, as Aronson put it. In the future, they talked about, everyone would be like Harriet Thompson, the 91-year-old who broke records earlier this year by completing a marathon in 7 hours and 7 minutes. It was Arison who introduced Thiel to scientists at the Dinner Salon a decade ago. Since then, Thiel has funded projects, such projects as a high-speed cooling technology for human organs so they could be preserved indefinitely, and a way to grow bones using stem cells to replace broken ones. I've always had this really strong sense that death was a terrible, terrible thing, he said. I think that's somewhat unusual. Most people end up compartmentalizing, and they are in some weird mode of denial and acceptance about death, but they both have the result of making you very passive. I prefer to fight it. This was excerpted from a piece that originally appeared in the Washington Post. On the Health and Science page, deep water disasters' lasting impact. It's been 5 years since the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, killing 11 and releasing a torrent of petroleum into the sea. But despite a massive multi-billion dollar cleanup effort, the effects of the largest marine oil spill in U.S. history may linger for decades. British Petroleum, which operated the rig, has already paid nearly $3 billion in penalties, and under the Clean Water Act could end up paying roughly $4,300 for each of the 3 million to 4 million barrels spilled. But as most of the Gulf's beaches appear clean and the seafood industry slowly recovers, the disaster's long-term environmental repercussions remain largely unknown. Just 25% of the oil spilled has been accounted for, and the impact of that missing oil on the Gulf's ecosystem could persist for generations. Much of the petroleum likely settled on the sea floor, threatening deep-sea corals and bottom-dwelling fish. Bottlenose dolphins, whales, and porpoises have been stranding themselves in large numbers along the shorelines, and the Gulf's population of oysters, crabs, and endangered Kemp's Ridley sea turtles have declined significantly. Dolphin death continues. Oil is still on the bottom of the ocean. Tar balls keep coming up. Cynthia Sartu, executive director of the Gulf Restoration Network, tells NPR.com, and nobody really is able to say what we may find in 5 or 10 years. The health scare of the week, the cost of a bad night's sleep. Heavy snoring may do more damage than irritating your partner. New research suggests that heavy snoring and sleep apnea, a respiratory disorder that causes repeated pauses in breathing during sleep, may contribute to early memory loss and dementia. A study of 2,500 people ages 55 to 90 found those with untreated nighttime breathing issues were diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment 10 years earlier and dementia 5 years earlier than those who slept soundly. But the findings also indicated that treating sleep apnea, which is typically done with a positive airway pressure machine, could offset the higher risk for early onset Alzheimer's. Whether treating sleep disorders truly slows down the decline is still not known, study lead author Ricardo Osiroo tells the New York Times, but there is some evidence that it might. On the Talking Points page, Dr. Oz promoting quack medicine? Dr. Oz is in trouble again, said Melissa Dahl in nymag.com. 10 months ago, the charismatic celebrity doctor was eviscerated in a Senate hearing for using his popular daytime TV show to promote green coffee beans, miracle fat burners, and other bogus weight loss supplements. In December, a British medical journal study found that about half Oz's medical advice is either baseless or flat out wrong. Now, 10 respected doctors have sent an open letter calling for his dismissal as vice chairman of surgery at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons, citing the cardiothoracic surgeon's disdain for science and his relentless opposition to genetically modified food. On his show, America's Doctor accused the letter writers of conflict of interest. Some of them have links to firms that produce genetically modified food and of trying to interfere with his freedom of speech. That's just a smokescreen, said Gabrielle Arana in HuffingtonPost.com. Oz's critics in the medical profession aren't trying to prevent him from promoting quack treatments on TV. They just want Columbia to stop leading credence to his fraudulent nonsense. Quackademic medicine is an important public health issue, said Alan Levinovitz in TheAtlantic.com. When respected individuals endorse medically unproven treatments like herbal supplements, acai berries, and energy healing, it encourages some patients to reject standard medical care. Scoff all you like. But there's a reason Oz's show is so popular, said Tara Culp Ressler in thinkprogress.org. While doctors think laymen should unquestioningly accept their authority, the general population is increasingly skeptical of doctors, big pharma, and government agencies. Nearly a third of Americans regularly seek out some form of alternative medicine, from fish oil to melatonin. Who can blame them, asked Bill Gifford in the New York Times. For all the medical profession's emphasis on evidence-based treatments, the truth is slipperier and more fluid than doctors admit. Millions of Americans are prescribed statins for high cholesterol, despite a lack of scientific proof that the drug actually prolongs life. Some doctors are quick to prescribe meds. Others take more natural approaches based on diets and exercise. Who's right? Who knows? Ultimately, medicine is a messy, contested affair, and you can't blame people for watching Dr. Oz's show to get a second opinion, and then maybe a third. A few notes here. Let's see. About 28% of Americans were totally sedentary last year, failing to participate in even one physical activity, such as running, lifting weights, yoga, bowling, or even stretching, a new study found. The Physical Activity Council said that roughly 83 million Americans age 6 and over did nothing at all to maintain fitness, an increase of 18% over 2007. More than a third of the children under age of 1 have already used a cell phone or tablet device, according to a survey by pediatric researchers. About 36% had learned to swipe and scroll down the screen, and 15% had used apps. Finally, a quote from Mike Tyson, "If you're not humble, life will visit humbleness upon you." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.